So for our final lecture, just want to finish up on the topic of asymptotics. Well, I'm not going to tell you everything about asymptotics, but I want to continue discussing asymptotics. And in particular today, we'll discuss two things. So one is Stokes' phenomena, which it basically refers to the fact that as we change the phase of our expansion parameter in an asymptotic expansion, generally there are abrupt changes in the asymptotic behavior of the function. And we'll illustrate that through an example. And then at the end of class, I just want to talk briefly about summation of divergent series. So many asymptotic series are divergent. And so we'll just try to understand a bit more detail what the meaning or whether a divergent series, in fact, has any meaning, or what sense we can assign a meaning to a divergent series. OK, so I'm going to illustrate Stokes' phenomenon through an example. And this will also illustrate one other technique we can use when we want to approximate a function using the saddle point method. So the examples we looked at yesterday and the example you looked at in tutorial, the contours that we're, or the functions were written in terms of an integral, and that integral had didn't have endpoints, or the endpoints were infinite. So if the endpoints are finite, there are additional things we need to do if we want to use the saddle point method. So we'll illustrate both of those things through the following example. And so first part of the lecture, we'll study this integral. And so first, let's try to understand what's going on as z goes to infinity for z real. And later, after we understand this case, we'll see what changes if we take the magnitude of z to infinity, but with a constant non-zero argument of z. And so this here is just a real integral.
Inside
the cosine, this says 5zt minus zt cubed. OK, so we might expect, based on our experience yesterday, that this integral is dominated near t equals 0. After all, we do have an exponential, it's even a Gaussian, like before, that contains e to the minus z times some function. And so we might expect that we can just neglect the cosine. This gets pretty small if t is big. So you might expect that we can just write it like this, which is just the Gaussian integral we can do. Now that doesn't work. And why not? So this is almost in the form we had last time, except we assumed the prefactor was independent of z. And in fact, you can see explicitly that this cosine is going to be important because this factor only becomes small is small for t, and t is greater than or about 1 over the square root of z. And so when t is 1 over the square root of z, the argument of the cosine is not small. And so we'd expect there to be destructive interference. So we expect that this actually goes to 0 much faster than this due to destructive interference. And we'll see that explicitly. So we can't use what we learned yesterday. If we just leave the integral in this form, we need to do some work to manipulate it so that everything that depends on z is in the exponent, and if we do have a prefactor, it's independent of z. We note that we can rewrite I of z just as the real part of this integral. And so it's also, would be equal to the real part of the integral from minus 1 to 0. So using that observation, we can write this integral as the integral from minus 1 to 1 dt, or half of this integral, because the imaginary part will cancel out. The imaginary part is just an odd integral over a symmetric region around 0. Okay. So now in this form, it's starting to look like we can use the saddle point approximation. And so let's introduce some shorthand notation. You can just pull out a factor of e to the minus 2z. And factor the argument of the exponential, where rho of t is just minus t minus I squared minus I t minus I cubed. So if we expand this out, include the z to the minus 2z, we'll just get back what we started with. So in this form, it now looks just like an integral that we studied yesterday, so that we can use the saddle point approximation. So the next thing to do is to deform our contour so that it goes through the saddle points, and we need to go through the saddle points following constant phase contours. And so the constant phase contours are determined by the imaginary part of rho, which we can write as 3uv squared minus 8uv plus 5u minus u cubed, where t is equal to u plus iv. And we also notice that there are, if we take the derivative of this, there are two saddles. Prime of t is just minus 2 t minus I minus 3i t minus I squared. And so this is 0 for t equals I or t equals 5i over 3. So another thing we notice that be important for trying to determine what contour we should deform this into is that the phase of this integral is different at the two endpoints. So the imaginary part of rho plus and minus 1 is just plus or minus 4. So if we just plug in plus or minus 1, plug in v equals 0, u equals plus or minus 1, these terms go away. We get just these two factors, and so we get plus or minus 4. And so let's just draw a sketch of what constant phase contours look like. So if we plot here the imaginary part of t and the real part of t, so there are 4 points that are interesting on this plot. So one is plus 1, minus 1. These are endpoints. And we have 2 other interesting points, plus I and plus 5i over 3. And so we can just plot what the constant phase contours look like, pass through these points. And they'll end up looking at something like this.
So
these lines, this is not the contour we're going to integrate along. This is related to but not equal to the contour we want to integrate along. So these are the constant phase contours. And we'll choose some part of these eventually to deform our contour. Integration contour on, but these are not yet our integration contour. Okay, so how should we deform our contour? So, well, we know how to approximate an integral that passes through a saddle point along a path of constant phase or a path of steepest descent. This integral has endpoints. So we're going to have to choose one of these some of these segments to integrate along. So it'd be a good idea to integrate along these contours of constant phase that pass through our endpoints, because we know that along a path of with constant phase, the integrand is either increasing or decreasing. And the only place that it can change from increasing to decreasing is at a saddle point. So along one direction in this curve, the integrand will be increasing. And along the other direction, it will be decreasing, because there's no saddle along this curve. So if we choose to go along the steepest descent path, then the dominant contribution, then we can approximate the integral along this part of the contour, along some part of the contour that ends, that goes to infinity and ends on one of the endpoints, by the endpoint if it decreases in the direction towards infinity. On the other hand, if it decreases towards the endpoint, then we are kind of stuck. We don't really know what to do, because the dominant contribution comes from the part that's over at infinity, which is hard to approximate. So we'd like to deform our contour into some combination of these constant phase contours so that when we're integrating away from the endpoints, we're going along the steepest descent direction. Because then we can approximate, so the steepest descent direction in this plot is in this direction. So this is down. This is also down. And you can determine that just by looking at what the real part of rho does along these contours. So if we choose to integrate in this way along this contour, the dominant part of the, let's call this part of the contour C1. The dominant part of the integral along C1 comes from a region around minus 1. So we could approximate it using this region of the integral. On the other hand, if we chose to use this part of the contour, we know that the integrand is increasing along this way. And so the dominant contribution along this part is coming from infinity. And likewise, we should use this part of the contour over here. And so we see that the natural way to complete the contour is to use, let's call this C2, is to take our contour, which originally we wanted to integrate from -1 to 1 along the real line, to be C1 plus C3 plus C2. So if we deform our contour in this way, we already know how to estimate the contribution from C3. And we can probably do something similar for the contributions from C1 and C2. Any questions on that? Long argument. And I just want to point out that the only way it would make sense to connect C1 and C2 is with a constant phase contour that passes through a saddle point. Because this integral decreases, the integrand along C3 decreases in both directions towards infinity. If we chose a constant phase contour that didn't pass through a saddle point, it would be increasing along one direction. And so that integral probably wouldn't exist. OK. So that's the first step in our approximation method. So now we're going to say that integral I z is equal to the integral along C1 plus the integral along C2 plus the integral along C3 of our exponential. And so we know how to compute the integral along C3. So the integral along C3, the exponential, using the saddle point approximation just gives us, this is asymptotic to 1 over 2, e to the minus 2z root pi over z, just using the formula from last time. Since rho of I is 0 and rho double prime of I is minus 1. OK, so that leaves us with the contributions from the endpoints. So how can we determine those? So one useful fact, it's known as the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. We'll use a slight generalization of this to figure out the contribution from the endpoints. This states that the integral from a to b of f of t e to the I x t goes to 0 as x goes to infinity if the integral from a to b of the absolute value of f exists. Okay. And so again, the reason for this is just that the contributions with different phase will oscillate. So if we take x to infinity, this integral will oscillate more and more quickly. And the contributions with different phase will cancel out. So it turns out that this, so we've got an integral that looks almost like this, except we have a function of t in the exponent. And it also works if we have an integral of the form I of x that has a function of t in the exponent, called psi of t. So this goes to 0 as x goes to 0, x goes to infinity. If we need to impose some additional conditions, so we still need the same condition that the integral of the absolute value of f exists. And we also need psi to be continuous and differentiable. And furthermore, we want psi not to be constant. On any subinterval. So with these conditions, this integral still goes to 0. And so we can use this then to figure out the contributions from our endpoints. And to do that, we need to integrate by parts. So our integral, well, first, just consider it a general integral of this form. So we can integrate this by parts, and we get minus 1 over ix, a to b, ddt, f of t, psi prime of t, e to the I psi t, t plus f t over I x psi prime of t e to the I x psi of t. And so this Riemann-Lebesgue lemma says this term goes to zero as, I'm missing an x here, as x goes to infinity. But we need to, this term goes to zero as x goes to infinity. So we still need f of t over psi prime of t to be continuous and differentiable. So, and then we'll have that I of x is asymptotic to f of t over ix psi prime of t e to the ix psi of t equals a to b as x goes to infinity as long as f of a over psi prime of a is non-zero, or f of b over psi prime of b is non-zero. So in that case, this goes to zero. So this term will be the dominant contribution to the asymptotics of the integral, as long as one of the contributions is non-zero. And so we can use this result then to figure out what the contributions from our endpoints are. So along C1, the integrand is decreasing as we go off towards complex infinity. And so only one endpoint will contribute. And so we get that the integral along C1 of our function is asymptotic to 1/2 e to the minus 2z times e to the z of rho of minus 1 over z rho prime of minus 1, which simplifies to I minus 4 over 68 z e to the minus 4 plus I z. And similarly for C2. And we just get the same thing with some signs changed. So we'll get a minus 4 minus I over 68 z e to the minus 4 plus I times z. Yes.
I don't really see how you got this.
This? Okay, so.
Yeah, our integral doesn't seem to be in
that form. Okay, so our so this is the form.
Yep.
So for our case, f is just 1.
Yep.
And I psi is equal to rho.
So psi is a complex function.
Psi can be complex. And so then, if we just compare this to what we have over here, the I's are different because I psi is equal to rho. But otherwise, it's just the same as what we've got here. And this factor was just the prefactor that was outside of our integral. OK.
I get back my original integral? Because I'm kind of confused with that. The integral from minus 1 to 1.
OK, so.
You pull the computer.
We are integrating from minus 1.
There, yeah.
In this direction, then along this direction, and then back up here. And there are two ways of thinking about it. So if we could just deform this contour continuously without passing through any poles, just by pinching together these parts and then bringing them back up to minus 1. So we could deform this into something that looked like, say, this. And then we can just continuously deform it something that looks like that. If that's hard to visualize, alternatively, we could write a closed contour that's equal to the integral along C1, then C3, then C2, then backwards along this, and there's no poles inside. So this integral is just equal to this integral.
Okay. Seems a little strange that this result falls at phi, if psi can be complex, right? Because in the simple example above, I mean, if t is complex, then you have an exponential integral. Depending on what x is that can either blow up or zero.
Minus IT.
Clearly that doesn't work. Well,
I think I'm missing a condition, but it will work for at least some psi complex. That's a good point, and ask me again later after class. But these. Yeah. It should hold at least in the condition I'm using it. I think I'm misstating something about the general case. Thank you for catching that. So we have three different contributions to I of Z. And two of them are irrelevant. Why is that? So I claim that our results so far tell us that I of Z is asymptotic to e to the minus 2z over root pi over z. Z goes to infinity. The argument of z was 0. And why is that? That's because the contributions from the endpoint are subdominant in the following sense, that 1 half e to the minus 2z root pi over z is much, much greater than our endpoint contributions. As z goes to infinity. So we're not justified in keeping these. After all, this is just the leading term in the asymptotic series for the integral along the contour C3. So any subleading terms that we have might be more important than these. In general, they will be. So this term is the only one we're justified in keeping in our approximation. So these two terms are subleading. These go to 0 faster, like e to the minus 4z. So they go to 0 much, much faster than the left-hand side. So we only get is one contribution. We send z to 0 in this particular way. But note that this depends on the angle at which we send z to infinity at. So what if we send z, absolute value of z to infinity with the argument of z non-zero. So in that case, that can change the relative importance of the different terms. So in particular, this saddle point contribution is only much greater than the endpoint contributions if the argument of z is less than the arctan of a half. Otherwise, one of these endpoint contributions will be more important. So if we just look at the ratio, so these factors of z won't affect anything. So really what we're looking at is the limit z goes to infinity of e to the 4 plus or minus I minus 1 z over e to the minus 2z, which is the limit of z goes to infinity of e to the 2 plus or minus 2i minus 1 z. And so whether or not this goes to 0 depends on what the angle, what the argument of z is. So in certain angles, this will go to 0. Certain angles, it won't. So for argument z less than arctan of half, this will go to 0. So the negative real part, the exponent. So in the other case, if the arctangent of a half is less than the absolute value of the argument is z, one of the endpoint contributions will dominate. And so if arctan of the half between the argument of z and pi, then the t equals minus 1 endpoint dominates. And by dominate, that means the contribution from this endpoint is much greater than the contribution from the other endpoint and the saddle point. Because I minus 4 over 68 z e to the minus 4 I plus 1 z is much greater than minus I minus 4 over 68 z e to the 4 I minus 1 z. In this limit, and in the other case, if and so in this case, I of z is asymptotic to this first one. This. And in the other case, if minus the arctan of a half is greater than the argument of z is greater than minus pi, then this one will dominate. So we see that there are three distinct cases for the asymptotic behavior. And they change abruptly as we change the argument of z. One thing we didn't do was check that our contour actually passed through the same saddle point for all angles that we could take z to infinity to. And in fact, it won't. So if the argument of z is greater than pi minus the arctangent of 2, then the constant phase contours will look something like this. This direction will be down. And so this would be the correct contour to deform our original integral into. So this contour does not pass through the saddle point. So we only have two contributions here. But this transition occurs after the exchange of dominance between the three different contributions. So it's not important here. But in other cases, we can get Stokes phenomena from abrupt changes in which saddle points the contours pass through. And so these contours are different from our original contours, just because if we in our original integral, we give z a phase, then the constant phase contours are the ones that have the imaginary part of z times rho constant for a fixed magnitude of z.
Contour coming edge of
-1 supposed to go above the real axis. That's what I drew in my notes, but I plotted it in Mathematica in the lecture notes that are on the wiki. Okay. So
yeah,
is that self-intersecting if you go from -1 to 1?
Well, in your lecture notes, it doesn't look so much that the left contour goes above the axis so much as the right one ends up like clearly like at above the axis, like at 1. Like
okay, at one. So this is probably a slightly sloppy drawing, but there is a mathematical plot in the lecture notes that one will be correct.
Like, I guess I just mean because in that, I could see how you could write that the integral from -1. Like on that diagram there,
uh-huh.
But there, like if it goes above the real axis, I can't see how you can join minus 1 and 1.
Okay, so I think this is just a sloppy drawing, but even if there was a self-intersection, the argument about the closed contour would still work. So we could.
So you can cross like contours?
Yeah, it's not a problem. Okay. So that's saddle point approximation. So we've seen through a series of examples that there are, yes?
So what in all this was Stokes phenomenon?
Stokes phenomenon is the abrupt change in the asymptotic behavior as we changed the argument or the phase of the parameter we were sending to infinity. So we saw there were three different cases. So if the argument of z was less in magnitude than the arctangent of half, then I of z was asymptotic to what I've written on the middle board up there. The argument of z lies in this range, we have this completely different expression for the asymptotic behavior of I of z, and a third expression in the other case. So that's that's what's known as Stokes phenomenon. So we are approximating an integral that depends in a, it doesn't look like it has any abrupt discontinuities in Z, but if we look at the asymptotic behavior, there are these jumps. So caused in this case by exchange of dominance, but in other cases it can be caused by changes in which saddles the constant phase contours go through. Okay, so that's the saddlement approximation. So a few key things to remember is that one, going through constant phase contours is crucial for the whole thing to work. So once we have a contour that goes through a saddle point, we all know the procedure, but we need to think carefully about the consistency of our approximations if we're trying to use that formula that we derived last time. So in the last part of class, I just want to talk briefly about the summation of divergent series. So many asymptotic series are divergent. We also run across divergent series in other contexts in physics. And so I'm just going to ask what is the meaning of these divergent series? Can we actually use them to do anything sensible? So there are several answers to that question. The first answer is that yes, experimentally, we often derive divergent series approximations of quantities we're interested in. And the first few terms often provide excellent agreement with experiment. So it at least based on experiment, it's not complete nonsense to use an asymptotic series. But I'm going to try to argue that there are sensible ways in which we can assign meanings to assign a finite number to a divergent series. Note we don't do that by adding up the terms in the series. Of course, that wouldn't make sense. The series is divergent. It doesn't have a well-defined sum, but there is, there are, in fact, many ways that we can assign finite numbers to divergent series that actually encodes some of the properties of the series that we might care about. And so before we do that, let's just look at a few examples of divergent series. So one series we could write down is this one. Also write down this series. Or this series. Or this series. So, okay, so why is this one a divergent series? What is it? Sorry. What is a divergent series?
It doesn't converge.
Doesn't converge, right? So, yeah, not nothing. That's all I was looking for. So this series is not convergent, therefore it's divergent.
Didn't Leibniz prove it was equal to 1/2 at some point?
We'll talk about this series. Yes. Okay. So what about this second series? It looks very much like the first series. Are these the same?
It's just inserted zeros everywhere.
Just inserted zeros. So why might you think they're the same?
Because zero is not.
But they both don't. Like you mean as a value of the sum of all of them? Because then you're asking, is a non-existent thing equal to a non-existent thing?
You can change ordering if you.
Right.
Zero is the identity under addition.
Okay. So let's.
One exactly.
I mean, I can think every pair and rewrite 1 + 0 as 1.
Yes, I've heard. So people want to. I've heard several answers, but it seems like consensus why you might think these are the same is that if we use the associative law, we could just put in parentheses, and write these terms become the same as those terms. I'll claim that's not a sensible thing to do if we want to assign some meaning to these series. Again, in that we're not going to assign meaning to them just by adding up the terms. And so why is using the associative law of addition infinitely many times a bad idea? That's because we can look at this first series, and if we're allowed to use the associative law infinitely many times, we can just write it like this. Which is just 0 + 0 + 0 + 0, which is a convergent series. And so we know how to assign to sum a convergent series, and we just get 0 in that case. We can also throw in parentheses in a different way. So we could write this as 1 plus minus 1 plus 1 plus minus 1 plus 1, and so on. And we get 1 + 0 + 0 + 0 + 0, which again is a convergent series. So addition is not infinitely associative. We get contradiction if we want to assign a meaning to expressions like this and assume that we can use associativity infinitely many times. So that doesn't work. That's not something we're allowed to do when we're manipulating infinite series. So these two series are different. We'll claim these are different series because we're not allowed to use associativity infinitely many times to relate these series. So that's something we're not allowed to do when we're manipulating divergent series. What about commutativity? So can we commute terms infinitely many times? So again, I'll argue that we get a contradiction if we're allowed to commute terms in a series infinitely many times. So you can write out the divergent series expansion for log 2 as following expression. And the sum of the positive terms diverges. As does the sum of the negative terms. So if we're allowed to commute terms in the series infinitely many times, we can make this series add up to anything we like, say pi, or e, or whatever your favorite number is. So to do that, we can take the following procedure. So we can first add up the positive terms in order until we get something greater than pi. And then we can subtract negative terms in order until we get something less than pi. And then add in positive terms, again, until we get something greater than pi, and so on. And the terms we're adding get smaller and smaller. So this procedure lets us turn this sum into any other value we like, say pi. So if we assume that addition is infinitely commutative, we get a contradiction. So addition is not infinitely commutative. So let's suppose we want to assign a finite number to a divergent series. One way we can do that is to first modify the series in some way to make it convergent. And Euler was one of the first people who came up with methods to do this. And so Euler's idea was that if we have a divergent series, and it diverges not too badly, so say the an just grow as some power of n, then if we define this function f, which is just the same coefficients times x to the n, then this will converge. Converges for the value of x less than 1. And then the Euler sum of the series is defined to be the limit as x goes to 1 from below f of x. And so this is one method in which we can assign a finite number, e, to a divergent series. And note, we're not getting this number by adding up the terms of the series. We're first modifying the series in some way, then getting an answer. And so let's look at an example. Can compute the Euler sum of 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, which is the sum n equals 1 to infinity of minus 1 to the n. And so for this example, f of x is the sum n equals 1 to infinity minus 1 to the n, x to the n. We would get a different answer if we started with a minus 1.
Because then it's minus 1 to the power of something minus 1, starting from minus 0.
Starting from n equals 0, yes. Thank you. And so if we sum this series, we get 1 over 1 plus x. This is just the Taylor series. And so the Euler sum is just the limit as x goes to 1 on the left of 1 plus x, which is just a half. So we've assigned a number to this divergent series. Okay, you may be wondering, great, but this seems very arbitrary. There's lots of other ways we could do it. So let's try another way and see what happens. And second way, we can try to assign a number to a divergent series. It's known as Borel summation. And the basic idea behind Borel summation is to use the following identity. So we know n factorial is gamma of n plus 1, which is the integral from 0 to infinity e to the minus t d to the n. And so if we just rearrange this identity, we can write 1 as integral of 0 to infinity dt e to the minus t times t to the n over n factorial. Okay. Now, if we have a divergent series, we can insert this identity, multiply each term in the sum by this identity, and so far we haven't done anything. But the idea behind Borel summation is, what if we swap the sum in the integral? So in that case, what we get is known as the Borel sum. So we have integral e to the minus t of a sum and this sum will define the sum looks very similar to the Euler sum, but we don't need the we can allow the ans to grow more quickly because we've got an extra 1 over n factorial here. So this will give us a finite answer for series that diverge even more quickly. And so this is another method we can use to assign a number to a divergent series. And so let's compute the Borel sum for the same series we've been looking at before. So first thing we need to do is sum the series part in the Borel sum, which is just minus 1 to the n, t to the n, over n factorial, or e to the minus t. And so then we can plug that back into our integral, and we get the Borel sum is the integral dt of e to the minus 2t. We have a minus t in the definition. Our sum is minus t, e to the minus t, which just gives us a half. Same answer as before. OK. They will, in fact. These always give us the same answer as long as they both exist. The Borel sum exists for a wider class of cases than the Euler sum. So in fact, we can get the same answer with several different methods. And we can recover the answer a half without even specifying a explicit way to sum the series. So we just assume that our summation procedure satisfies two properties. One, that if you do our summation procedure on a series, we get the same thing as if we add together the first term in our series and then sum the rest. And secondly, we assume our summation procedure is linear. So if we have the sum of some alpha an plus beta bn, we get alpha s we get just a it just obeys a linearity property. So any summation procedure that satisfies these two properties will give us the same result of 1/2 for the series 1, minus 1, 1, et cetera. To see that, just write at s is the sum of 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, et cetera. Is using our first property, it's 1 plus the sum of minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 etc., which is 1 minus the sum of our original series using the second property. Here we go, number 1, number 2. And so we see that S is equal to 1 minus S, which tells us that S equals a half. Okay. So these procedures I've shown you so far we can learn a few things from this. So first of all, wide classes of procedures for assigning numbers to divergent series always, I'll give you the same number. And so we'll see later in the year, we'll encounter divergent series several times, and we'll look at other procedures for assigning finite numbers to divergent series. And it's a well-defined procedure. So if we define a procedure and we have a divergent series, there's a unique answer we get for. It's not complete nonsense to assign numbers to divergent series, but note that in none of these procedures are we just adding up the terms. So that definitely doesn't make sense. But there are other ways we can recover the information contained in a divergent series. So we often get a divergent series answer to something we know is finite. And so there still is information contained in that divergent series that we can't get out.
How was that last idea? So what is that information? What's its meaning?
What's its meaning? So often if you know enough you might get a divergent series, say from computing an asymptotic series. So many asymptotic series are divergent. So the asymptotic series do contain information about the original function. Not all the information in general. Remember, we can add non-perturbative terms to them, but they still do tell us something about the original function. And if you know something about what those non-perturbative terms are, you can recover the original function. So usually alone, these don't tell you what the original function was. But if you supplement it with additional information, you can sometimes recover the original function or some properties of it, at least.
You might have answered this, so I'm sorry for repeating yourself. But if there is a convergent series, will it summation this way coincide with what we know it to sum up to?
Yes. So there are lots of different procedures for assigning numbers. Usually, a property we like to require is that they always give the same answer as the sum of convergent series. So that's certainly a desirable property, and the examples I've given you do have that property. Okay, so there's one more section in my notes that I won't go through carefully, but I just wanted to point out that for practical purposes, we often compute in perturbation theory, all we know how to do is compute an asymptotic series, which diverges. And for a wide variety of cases, the asymptotic series best approximates the original function if you just truncate the series at its smallest term. And if doing so often gives you exponential accuracy. So there's always this non-perturbative ambiguity. So we can add a non-perturbative function that's like an exponential of, say, minus 1 over lambda squared. That's quite good and often much better than convergent series. Divergent series, even though they don't converge, can converge faster than convergent series. as self-contradictory as that sounds, but they do work, and we'll come back to this later in the year. Various methods for assigning finite numbers to divergent things, divergent series, and so that's all I wanted to say on this topic. So we've had a long and winding path from path integrals through distributions, Green's functions, orthogonal functions, and now asymptotic series. And so topics haven't always been closely connected, but I do hope that you find all the things you've learned in this course useful throughout the year. So thank you.